When one member of this body brings the dignity of the institution into question, it's incumbent upon all of us to act to defend it.
Censured, a Mat-Su representative is formally reprimanded for comments he made about rural women and abortion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Walker addresses the Anchorage Assembly, urging support for his preferred budget solution.
And the message is we need a compromise. I need a compromise. Not everybody's going to get everything they want when they want it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Apply at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Representative David Eastman became the first member of the Alaska House to be censured today. The House voted 25-14 to condemn Eastman for saying some women, including those who live in villages, are glad to become pregnant so they can receive Medicaid-funded travel to have abortions. Anchorage Democratic Representative Ivy Sponholz says Eastman's comments merited censure. Censure is a formal condemnation, but doesn't carry any other repercussions.
When one member of this body brings the dignity of the institution into question, it's incumbent upon all of us to act to defend it. The representative from the northwestern part of the Mat-Su calls into question the character of women from rural Alaska and offended the dignity of all women.
Eastman says his comments weren't intended to blame any woman or group. Other legislators described his remarks as racist and misogynistic.
I did not want them to be used in any way that would hurt anyone. I understand that people were hurt by them, and I'm very sorry that I said them. I'm very sorry that people were hurt.
Eastman also expressed concern about the effect of political correctness.
We have a choice before us as a society on whether we will lean more towards focusing on what's being talked about, what's intended by a statement, or focusing more on how someone could have interpreted that statement.
Members from both the mostly Democratic majority and Republican minority condemned Eastman's comments. Bethel Democrat Zach Fansler says concern from constituents in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta led to his vote for censure.
The women of the YK Delta will not forget. They will not forget that it was stated that someone would spend months pregnant to allow them to travel. An offensive and impermissible statement.
Most minority members say censuring Eastman would set a bad precedent. The only two Alaska legislators to be censured were both senators. They were George Homan in 1982, related to a bribery conviction that led to his expulsion, and George Jacko in 1993 for sexually harassing teenage girls. Alaska's U.S. senators have responded somewhat differently to President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
In a written statement, Senator Lisa Murkowski emphasized the timing. She says the firing came, quote, in the middle of an investigation into Russia's interference in our election. She called that serious cause for concern. Senator Dan Sullivan's statement was more deferential to the president. He says the timing raises questions that will need to be answered by the administration. But Sullivan notes the president has the power to choose a new FBI director. He says the FBI and the Senate Intelligence Committee's Russia investigations should continue. And Sullivan says the probes should cover the unmasking of private citizens, a reference to actions by the Obama White House. In another reference to the prior administration, Sullivan suggested the White House and federal agencies have eroded the rule of law over the past several years. Alaska Democratic Party Chairwoman Casey Steinau faults both senators for not calling for a special prosecutor. She calls their statements vague.
And not decisive and not standing up for what is clearly a problem when the president fires the very person who is running and leading the investigation on the White House.
Murkowski spokeswoman Karina Peterson says the senator believes the option of a special prosecutor should be considered.
She hasn't said specifically what's the best path forward in the ongoing investigation. That's what the next days, weeks will determine as she finds out more information and speaks with her colleagues.
Neither senator granted interview requests before they boarded Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's plane bound for an Arctic Council meeting in Fairbanks. Congressman Don Young was traveling too. His office issued a statement with no criticism of the firing or its timing. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
It will soon be up to a half dozen Matsu jurors to decide whether an Anchorage couple started a costly willow wildfire in 2015, known as the Sockeye Fire. Over 3 weeks, the jury heard testimony and examined evidence in the trial of Greg Imig and Amy DeWitt. The husband and wife are charged with criminally negligent burning for allegedly letting a smoldering brush fire escape a burn pit on their recreational property. Today, State Prosecutor Eric Senta recapped all the evidence presented during the trial. Evidence, the state says, proves the couple allowed embers to creep through dry moss and eventually burn thousands of acres. Senta told the jurors they should convict Imig and DeWitt.
They were aware of the concept of creepage. They were aware of the concept of smoldering. They were aware of the concept that that specific moss had burned in the past, yet still turned their backs on it. Mr. Imig and Ms. DeWitt caused the Sockeye Fire, and it was caused by their recklessness, and it was caused by their negligence. And they are guilty of all the crimes as charged.
But defense attorney Kevin Fitzgerald says the state is wrong. The defense presented expert witnesses, including a former Anchorage fire investigator, who refute the claim that the blaze started on Imig and DeWitt's property.
Throughout your deliberations, you should permit neither sympathy nor prejudice to influence you, nor may potential public opinion impact your decision. Both Ms. DeWitt and Mr. Imig still have that cloak, that presumption of innocence, even today and even now. And it remains with them until you go into the jury deliberation and begin to deliberate.
The jury will start deliberations tomorrow. One way or the other, there's still a chance the Sockeye Fire, which cost $8 million to fight, could land in civil court with a lawsuit from the victims, dozens of whom lost their homes. Governor Bill Walker made a visit to the Anchorage Assembly during last night's meeting. The governor used the opportunity to update the Assembly members about the state's budget battle in the legislature.
And really the message is we need a compromise. I need a compromise. I don't get everything I want when I want it. And that's just going to be the situation we're going to have in Juneau, is that not everybody's going to get everything they want when they want it.
Governor Walker says in spite of the current gridlock over proposals from the House and Senate, he's optimistic a plan will come through this session. Walker has been making the rounds in Anchorage the last 2 days, recapping cuts to state programs and facilities, and stressing his preference for a fiscal solution that balances cuts with a permanent fund restructure and broad-based taxes. The Assembly's reception to Walker was generally supportive, with the notable exception of Assemblymember Amy Demboski, who criticized the governor's figures on budget and service cuts. Demboski told Walker she rejects his premise that new revenues are necessary.
I don't agree with you, and many of our constituents that we both represent don't agree that there has to be a broad-based tax. Some will tell you that, in fact, we have a revenue problem. That's what I'm hearing you say. I hear others say we have a spending problem. Governor Walker, I think we have a leadership problem.
After a few questions, the governor departed. Elsewhere in the meeting, the body addressed minor zoning issues and the approval of 4 new commercial cannabis licenses. Alaska revenue officials have set up a system to tax licensed marijuana businesses, but due to Alaska's geography, actually getting the money to the state isn't always easy. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Paying taxes isn't fun, but it's usually pretty straightforward. Mail a check, pay online. But take James Barrett. He and his brother own Rainforest Farms in downtown Juneau, which is doing a brisk trade in legal pot.
We're able to do banking, but we can't put any of our cash sales into that bank account.
Why not?
Because it's drug money.
Drug money. That's how the federal government views the proceeds from Juneau's first legal weed outlet. None of the banks in Juneau will accept pot money, so his business can't write checks. But there's always cash. That's why Alaska's revenue department set up a cash drop-off point in downtown Anchorage. Yet for businesses off the road system, like Juneau, driving to Anchorage isn't an option.
Revenue said, hey, we set up this P.O. box to receive cash payments. You guys can start using it now. And we're like, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Revenue. That's great.
The state taxes marijuana bud at $50 an ounce. Rainforest Farms has racked up a tax bill in the thousands. In mid-April, he dropped a brick of cash into the mail, insured, naturally.
About an hour or so after I shipped my payment out, I got a phone call from the post office, and they said, come pick this up. We're not going to send it.
Tacked to the rejected parcel was a printout reminding him of federal law.
Proceeds from marijuana sales are illegal to send through the mail. And that does include tax payments, even though it's legal in the state of Alaska.
That's Jeremy Leader with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service in Seattle.
From my agency's perspective, you know, we have not seized any of these tax payments, and we really have no plans to. It's just, if you're going to use the United States mail, you have to abide by federal regulations, and marijuana businesses in Alaska sort of have to know that.
That the feds are throwing up roadblocks for state taxpayers isn't just exasperating for marijuana businesses. Here's State Tax Director Ken Alper.
It's such a weird in-between world we're in. I mean, this is a licensed business. These guys have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, gone through a pretty intense regulatory process, state and local, multiple levels. Their whole files are on the internet, hundreds of pages of documents, but yet they're operating and they're prevented from doing just the normal things that a business is supposed to be able to do, like use a bank or pay their taxes.
In the end, Barrett bought a plane ticket to Anchorage to pay his taxes in person. He admits there may be alternatives. He could set up a shell company, hire a courier, or invent some other workaround. But his point is he shouldn't have to.
We want to do business like regular businesses do. In America, we have a common currency for a reason, just so that all these businesses can work together.
Postal Inspector Jeremy Leader says new guidance from the Department of Justice or an act of Congress is needed before the Postal Service can change its policy.
I think it can kind of be attributed to, you know, the states are moving a lot faster than the federal government on when it comes to marijuana laws. You know, until that changes, the Postal Service and the Inspection Service will have to sort of abide by those laws.
Alaska's geography means there really isn't any way in or out of roadless communities without triggering some sort of federal jurisdiction, even though it's not leaving the state. That needs to be addressed, says the Tax Division's Ken Alper.
The issue comes down to, we don't want a new rule. We want to interpret what's being shipped as something other than the proceeds of a drug transaction. In our view, it is tax money.
Clarity in Washington has been in short supply. On one hand, Congress passed a $1 trillion spending bill last week that extends a rule barring the federal government from using funds to block state marijuana laws. But in a signing statement, Trump said he reserves the right to ignore it. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, for all the darkness people in Utqiagvik endure, Alaska's northernmost community actually sees a lot of daylight.
The summer is longer than the winter is by several weeks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson flew to Fairbanks today, accompanied by both of Alaska's U.S. senators. Tillerson is preparing to meet with his counterparts from seven other Arctic nations tomorrow morning. That's when the U.S. will formally hand over the two-year chairmanship of the Arctic Council to Finland. The handoff comes at a moment when U.S. Arctic policy is up in the air. Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk is in Fairbanks, and we have her on the line. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori.
Rachel, set the scene for us. What's the backdrop to this meeting?
Yeah, the big issue hanging over this conference is climate change. The Arctic Council has been very focused on climate change, scientific research, sustainable development, especially under the U.S. chairmanship for the past 2 years, which has been under the Obama administration. Of course, all of the countries here have signed the Paris Climate Agreement. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is deciding whether to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement right now, and there's a decision is expected within the next few weeks. So there's really questions hanging over the conference. conference of whether the U.S. is going to continue its commitments on climate change and on funding climate research. A Finnish representative told the New York Times that the Trump administration actually has asked to remove language directly related to the Paris Accord from the joint agreement that's going to come out of this meeting. So I think for people here, there's really just a feeling of whiplash going from the Obama administration and Secretary of State John Kerry, very focused on climate change, very focused on scientific research, to the Trump administration, which is skeptical on climate change, skeptical on some scientific research, skeptical of international institutions. And the Arctic Council is like the most international of international institutions. It runs entirely on consensus. It's very slow. So I think there's just questions about sort of how engaged the Trump administration will be.
Well, given all that, what are you hearing from people up there?
Well, so as I said, climate change is a big concern. You know, folks here emphasize that the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the world, that climate change impacts are showing up in the region first. And so there's big questions about sort of, you know, how the U.S. is going to engage with those issues. But people also say the rest of the world is going to move forward no matter what the U.S. does. I spoke with Annika Nilsson of the Stockholm Environment Institute in Sweden, and here's what she said.
Of course it raises concerns. U.S. is a big emitter of greenhouse gases that need to change. But I think actually the world is changing anyway without the U.S. now. There is a momentum in terms of transformation, actually, of the global energy systems.
And on top of the climate change concerns, there's also worries about whether the U.S. will stay engaged in Arctic issues. The Arctic Council, the way that the U.S. engages is through the State Department, and President Trump has proposed major funding cuts for the State Department. So there's some worry about whether the U.S. will remain a big player. But I spoke with Ambassador David Bolton. He's the chief U.S. official for the Arctic Council. And he said, you know, U.S. Arctic policy hasn't really changed since the early 90s. And that means a focus on the environment, sustainable development, scientific research, political stability. And he's not sure that's going to change.
The Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration all developed their own version of U.S. Arctic policy, but they're mostly similar. This new administration has not yet begun that process. But my own feeling is that the U.S. interests in the Arctic are long-term and enduring, and they have a lot to do with the state of Alaska, and that's not changing.
Rachel, what should we expect tomorrow?
Yeah, so tomorrow morning is the actual meeting of all of the foreign ministers representing, and obviously the Secretary of State representing the Arctic states. So Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and his counterparts at the seven other Arctic countries will meet for about 90 minutes. It will probably be pretty scripted, very formal. The U.S. will hand the gavel to Finland, which is the next chair. They're expected to sign an agreement on research cooperation, and then they'll issue this joint statement, and that's the Fairbanks Declaration, and it's written by consensus. Every country has to sign off on it. So it might give us a sense of how far the Trump administration is willing to go when it comes to making commitments on climate change.
All right. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori.
That's Rachel Waldholz of Alaska's Energy Desk speaking to us from Fairbanks. She's covering tomorrow's meeting of the Arctic Council. While the Arctic Council convenes in Fairbanks, the after party is happening in Anchorage. After delegates, dignitaries, and stakeholders finish up their high-level council meetings, the Anchorage Museum will host North by North, a festival focused on issues spread across the circumpolar north. Museum Director Julie Decker says the 4 days of events are meant to keep the focus on Alaska during international conversations about the future of the Arctic.
If there's a lot of people from outside looking in, it's really important to have the inside represented by the people who live here and to empower the voice of Alaskans at a time when there's a lot of curiosity and interest in our place.
North by North will feature academic and policy-focused presentations on everything from U.S.-Russian relations to the status of global ivory bans on indigenous carvers. But there's also a push to reach a broader audience. The festival includes outdoor film screenings, food trucks dishing out northern cuisine, and rooftop dance parties DJed by global musicians. Those same performers are also part of a panel discussion on the topic of Arctic music. Decker says the museum is making a deliberate effort to reorient what comes to mind when people think about the high north.
We want to celebrate the place we live in and the people who live here, and really want to help change the narrative for our place and to move it from the idea that we're in an uninhabited place of natural resources and say this is a contemporary place that expects to grow, that is optimistic about its own future, and we're trying to put the emphasis on the human qualities of the Arctic.
The North by North Festival kicks off with a live streaming of the ministerial meeting in Fairbanks tomorrow morning. It wraps up on Sunday with a craft fair and Mother's Day brunch.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Participants in the Arctic Broadband Forum held this week at the University of Alaska Fairbanks got an update on the progress of a project that promises to bring high-speed internet to remote northern Alaskan communities. And while residents of those towns and villages overwhelmingly support plans to bring broadband into the area, some worry about the flood of Western culture that will come with greater access to the internet. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The head of the company that just completed the first phase of a fiber optic cable system that brought much faster internet connectivity to Prudhoe Bay says if all goes well, the company will extend that broadband to five other northern Alaska communities as early as November.
These markets are demanding service and desperate for this service.
Quintillion CEO Elizabeth Pierce says the broadband that her Anchorage-based company will offer to the local internet service providers will improve the quality of life for the residents of Utqiagvik, the city formerly known as Barrow, as well as Wainwright, Point Hope, Kotzebue, and Nome.
With broadband, you get access to education, and with education, you get access to well-paying jobs.
Broadband could also help generate economic activity in remote communities and offer young people an alternative to leaving the village for a job in the city, says Heather Hudson, an expert who's studied the trend that has decimated the population of many Indigenous communities in Canada, much as it has in Alaska.
Unemployment is high. It's very similar to Alaska. Cost of living is also high, similar to Alaska. And the population is young. Half the people in Nunavut are under 25.
Hudson is an affiliate professor with the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research. And she and others at the forum talked about how broadband would improve e-commerce, telemedicine, and education in the villages. But some Alaska Natives and their Indigenous counterparts in other Arctic nations worry about the downside of broadband.
I just feel that you know, high technology is good, you know, but there's a time and place that it should be used.
Steve Umatuk is an elder in the northwest Alaska village of Point Hope, and he said in an interview last year that he worries about broadband making it hard for young people to appreciate their Indigenous culture.
I try to let the younger generation understand that they have an identity that should never be forgotten, and that you have a rich history, a rich culture.
Many Indigenous peoples worry about their youths losing interest in their language and traditions, and some fear broadband could aggravate the problem.
There is concern, and there should be concern.
Cheryl Stein is executive vice president of ASRC, the Inupiaq-owned Arctic Slope Regional Corporation based in Utqiagvik.
I mean, we absolutely hear that concern because I think that what we have are a lot of people that are glued to their phones, not paying much attention to the other things that are going on around them.
But Stein says that doesn't mean Alaska Natives should turn their backs on the technology. Rather, she says, parents, educators, and other community members must teach young people how to responsibly use it.
We need to be good parents. We need to be engaged with our kids, you know, pay attention to what they're looking at, making sure that they don't get mired in the things that potentially could be negative about the internet.
Some, like Patrick Savick, the Northwest Arctic Borough's chief of staff, believe broadband could actually help Indigenous peoples preserve their cultures.
I think it's a positive. As we've seen our language and culture stripped away from us, the advent of broadband connectivity and iPhones and Samsung and all these apps opens this new world back to us.
Stein says broadband could facilitate greater sharing of native culture by allowing schools and other institutions to download large files of data, such as those stored in an Inupiat cultural repository in Utqiagvik.
We have an incredible amount of content that resides at the Inupiat History, Language, and Culture Commission in Barrow that the villages really can't access because of no broadband, right? There's too much lag, it takes too much time.
Stein says ASRC has invested in the Quintilian project in part to help share more widely the cultural resources, such as those managed by the Inupiat History, Language, and Culture Commission. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska is once again the land of the midnight sun. If you live in Utqiagvik, the sun won't set again for another 83 days. Brian Bretschneider, with our segment Ask a Climatologist, told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit the sun rose this morning in Utqiagvik at 2:54.
And this is notable because it's not going to set for quite a while, till 1:56 a.m. on August the 2nd. So it's literally going to become, as it does every summer, the land of the midnight sun. So, and this will actually be the first time it's midnight sun with the new name, after the name change. So there's something notable about that.
And do they have the same amount of 24-hour sun in the summer as 24-hour darkness in the winter?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there's this kind of this notion that, well, this all balances out. You know, you get all this sunlight in the summer, and then you get the darkness in the winter. But it's actually not the case. So up in Utqiagvik, they have 84 days with 24-hour sunlight. And in the winter, it's 65 days with no sunrise. So that's about a 19 or 20-day difference. So there's really, the summer is longer than the winter is by several weeks. And the reason for that is the shape of the Earth's orbit. So we're actually not quite a circle orbiting the sun. We're like an ellipse. And in the summer, we're farther away from the sun. So to conserve angular momentum, the Earth moves a little slower around the orbit. And so consequently, our summers then are longer than our winters.
That's amazing. That's not a small difference.
It's not a small difference. There are some other considerations based on the trajectory of the sun and the size of the sun's disk. But that's true everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, that summer is longer than winter.
It seems like we're cheating or something.
Well, so when people say, yeah, but you know, you get all this daylight in the summer and darkness and it all evens out, and that's not actually the case. Again, if you map out the amount of daylight for the entire globe, it maxes out right at the Arctic Circle, so right here through Alaska. We actually get more hours of daylight through the course of the year than they do, say, in the lower 48, anywhere in the lower 48, or anywhere in the Southern Hemisphere. Today being May 10th, pretty much anywhere in Alaska, from Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, we're actually already have more daylight than they'll see in the lower 48, even on their longest day of the year. So we're really adding daylight fast, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 minutes a day, depending on your latitude, and still have about another 5 or 6 weeks to go to add even more daylight.
All right. Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholtz and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Casey Grove, Zachariah Hughes, and Annie Feit in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.